It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard is out today. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll talk to the Wisconsin-based editor of a collection of first-person accounts of 1964's Freedom Summer in Mississippi. First, some big news today for Milwaukee. This morning, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development announced that the Milwaukee Housing Authority will receive a $30 million grant to redevelop the Westlawn Public Housing Campus. Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Mary Spacuzza was at today's press conference, and she joins us now. Mary, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us a little bit about this Westlawn neighborhood in Milwaukee.
It's interesting. So it's by the corner of like North 64th and around Silver Spring, but it also is a pretty huge project. It spans, I think at one point it was 75 acres. It was Wisconsin's largest public housing project. And if you look at it, there's the Westlawn Gardens, which has already been rebuilt, and that reopened in 2013. And it's very modern, environmentally friendly buildings. But then you look across the street, and it's kind of these 1950s boxy brick, almost like barrack-style houses. One of the residents called it like the old Westlawn, and it definitely looks a lot older and just kind of a little bit more depressing than the other side.
It seems like this particular grant is trying to look at things a little differently. Instead of, hey, we're going to tear down some old buildings and put up some new buildings, it seems like they're trying to think more in terms of how the neighborhood works.
Yeah, they are. One of the interesting components of it is that while people are moved, some of them are going to be temporarily relocated in foreclosed homes that are being rehabbed. So that's a way to kind of avoid, you know, vacant, blighted, foreclosed homes and have people temporarily go live in them after they've been fixed up. And they can choose to go back to Westlawn or they can choose to stay or go elsewhere. So that's really interesting. It's kind of trying to broaden it out so it's not just tearing down and building new buildings, but also helping the community as a whole. Also, the superintendent of Milwaukee Public Schools was there, Chief Flynn. They were talking about kind of how this is not just about buildings, but also about helping the community and the people who live there.
Well, a $30 million grant, I understand there's an effort to bring in matching private and other funds as well. Can you talk through how the money will be used in this rebuilding project?
Sure. So, they are hoping to get matching grants, so it could be much bigger than that by the end of the day. They're trying to, one of the first things they're going to do is redevelop some of these foreclosed homes for people to relocate so they can start breaking ground and tearing down some of those old developments and redoing them. They're also going to be doing mixed use or mixed income, so they're hoping to have like a grocery store with the idea that it's a lot easier for people to eat healthier food, especially if they don't have cars, if there's a grocery store in the community, so they're not kind of buying, someone mentioned buying an apple at the gas station across the street, which probably is not going to be maybe the best apple you could find. They're also talking about working with education and career centers and just really kind of trying to have, build a community and not just a brick and mortar.
Right. I think there have been accusations that public housing is just kind of people storage. It sounds like they're trying to actually have a connection to the place that people are living here.
Yeah, they mentioned community gardens and how for a very small fee you can get a plot of land to garden, having more environmentally friendly buildings, and also just kind of the layout. So there are, places where people can gather and kids can be outside playing, and it's not just kind of row after row of 1950s brick houses.
Talking to Mary Spacuzza from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about a grant announced today to redevelop, rebuild a Milwaukee neighborhood. So outside of, you mentioned, of course, the residential part of this, some retail, is there talk of schools, libraries, transportation being part of the formula here?
Yeah, and there already is kind of this cool Milwaukee Public Library Express. It's almost like a red box for books on the corner. And so they are talking about trying to do all of those things and really just kind of trying to take a broader approach. Sounds like they're going to be redeveloping more than 700 housing units, and that includes, I think, almost 400 replacement units. So so it is a pretty, it's large scale, and it's also, they are trying to think of education and other other factors.
This was a competitive grant process. There were 33 projects. Milwaukee was one of five finalists. What did the Housing and Urban Development say about why Milwaukee's proposal was one of the ones that was successful?
Yeah, there were only five to win across the nation. Milwaukee was one of them. I think it was a total of $150 million, with Milwaukee getting $30 million. The Deputy Secretary of HUD, who was here today, just said that it was really Milwaukee just had a really strong proposal that was more holistic, more kind of just very developed, very advanced, she said, and because of the focus on education, because of that it was just really trying to take a broad approach to redevelopment. She talked about going to a living roof or working with, gardeners and things where people would have access to fresh fruits and vegetables, and just a lot of other proposals didn't have that.
You mentioned some of the dignitaries present there, along with Mayor Barrett, the police chief, and others. Did you get a sense that this wasn't a business-as-usual kind of thing? Are they excited about this opportunity?
Yeah, it was, a lot of people who were there in the audience, I figured that they had won something but didn't realize it was $30 million. And one of the women from the community who was sitting next to me, called out, thank you, Jesus. And there was just, this huge eruption of applause and people cheering. And, it was a pretty fun Monday morning.
Is there a timeline of when ground will be broken on construction in this grant?
It sounds like by spring. It sounds like the first thing that's going to happen is the redeveloping the foreclosed homes, and then they're hoping to break ground by spring. It's actually going to follow up with someone to get more details on the timeline, but so I'm not sure when they aim to have it completed or when they aim to have people actually moving into the new developments. But stay tuned. Hopefully, we'll get that soon.
And Mary, before I let you go, was there a sense in Milwaukee that, hey, if we needed a big project in one place, this Westlawn neighborhood would be a good place to start?
You know, it's interesting because Mayor Barrett actually mentioned some of the downtown redevelopment that's been happening. There's obviously the arena that's going to be built. He kind of said, I'm a big cheerleader for the downtown renaissance, but my heart is in the neighborhoods. And the idea of just developing downtown isn't enough, that people need to have a dignified place to live. And he talked about that. Other people talked about that as well. So obviously this is a large scale project and also affecting a lot of people, a lot of kids, a lot of families.
Mary, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
That was Mary Spacuzza telling us about the $30 million federal grant that was announced today for Milwaukee's Westlawn neighborhood. Mary covers politics and breaking news at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. 50 years ago, President Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act at the height of the civil rights movement. Producer Brianne Chasseau went to Alabama, where she followed a Wisconsin mother and daughter as they crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge during the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, one of the events that preceded the passage of the act.
You're ready to cross the bridge?
I'm ready.
12-year-old Danielle Krim of Fitchburg and her mother Dawn are leaning against a tan building in downtown Selma, Alabama. They're surrounded by thousands of people, all waiting to cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge for the historic reenactment of Bloody Sunday on its 50th anniversary.
Well, I'm looking forward to kind of feeling how Martin Luther King and all the other people felt when they went across that bridge, and feeling their spirits walking with me.
Just having an opportunity to experience history with my daughter. My mom did this with me when I was little. We had never gone back to anything this historic, but she was always one that made sure that we understood our history. And I think we had a special bond because of it. And I'm wanting to have that bond with my daughter. So I just felt like this is something that we needed to do together.
Dawn and Danielle are involved in a national health movement called Girl Trek. Made up of thousands of African-American women, Girl Trek encourages healthy living through walking. Hundreds of Girl Trekkers from around the country are in Selma for the anniversary, taking buses to be here today.
Well, it just adds another level to coming, because the reason this group of women came together was because those sheroes walked and made changes. And so it really is about taking care of ourselves, bonding, supporting one another, empowering one another, but also remembering that those women walked, and because they walked, lives changed, and because we walk, lives can change.
Eventually, Dawn, Danielle, and their fellow Girl Trekkers become a part of the crowds moving toward the bridge for the historic reenactment.
And you just see a sea of people headed with one purpose and one focus, and that's what the march is about. Right now, we just feel like we're at a main street headed toward history.
I see a lot of people, like a lot of people, and a giant bridge with this arc thing over it that has holes in the top of the arc thing that has the word Edmund Pettus Bridge on it.
The crowd inches along, and a walk that usually takes 15 minutes or so stretches to more than an hour as thousands cross. But it's worth it. Eventually, Dawn and Danielle make it to the middle of the bridge.
You know, even though it was moving slow, that little bit of determination, think about all it took for them to get over that bridge. We didn't have any armed guards or horses or anything waiting on us. But I'm glad we did this.
I feel very proud of myself and my mom and everyone else who came today to walk across this bridge, because it was a very long walk. And I feel very proud of the people who came 50 years ago who walked across this bridge for their own rights.
All right, we're going to walk back down, shall we?
We shall.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org. In the summer, before those famous marches in Selma, there was a campaign known as Mississippi Freedom Summer Project, a highly organized effort to help African Americans in the Deep South register to vote. Joining us now to talk more about that turbulent time is Michael Edmonds, Deputy Director of the Library Archives at the Wisconsin Historical Society. He's the editor of the book Risking Everything, a Freedom Summer Reader, collecting firsthand stories of that era. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, take us to Freedom Summer. Talk about what was going on there and who was directing that, who was leading that effort to get people to vote.
It was conceived in the late fall and winter of 63 and 64 by leaders of SNCC and CORE, SNCC being the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and CORE the Council on Racial Equality. And they had been working together and separately in Mississippi and in the Deep South for 2-3 years without really having much effect. It just didn't get any publicity or cause any change when black people were discriminated against or beat up or even killed. And they thought if they could attract a large number of northern white volunteers, and they were the ones getting their heads beat, it might change the country's attitudes.
Well, talk about the people. The people would go around in teams, door-to-door in African-American communities, some local African-Americans and some Midwesterners, maybe even Wisconsin students often.
About 30 young people from Wisconsin volunteered to go down that summer of 1964. There were about 900 students or northerners and in all, and about 120 paid staff members from SNCC and CORE. And voter registration was part of what they did. The white volunteers lived in the segregated black communities, experienced poverty as they had probably never imagined it before, and spent part of each day going around trying to persuade black people it was worthwhile to go to the county courthouse and try to register to vote, even though it would cost them their home or their job or their livelihood. It was a big thing to ask of people. And as the child who was on Wisconsin Life a minute ago said, you gain a new respect for the courage of those local people as you study the events.
Let's talk more about that risk, because you think now if you're doing a door-to-door get-out-the-vote campaign, somebody might yell at you if they disagree with you or don't want you on their porch. There's some very serious consequences for people. Can you talk about the threats they faced?
Well, on the very first day of Freedom Summer, June 21st, 1964, Three volunteers were stopped by the police, taken to jail in a small town in Mississippi, and after dark turned over to the Klan. It was several weeks later before their bodies were found, and they had been tortured and murdered. All the volunteers knew when they went missing what had happened to them, and they all realized they were risking their lives by being down there to confront segregation.
Talking to Michael Edmonds, author of the book, editor of the book, Risking Everything, A Freedom Summer Reader. Well, let's meet some of the people in the book, some of the firsthand stories. A combination of courage and terror, I think you said once, permeates the stories they tell. Tell us some of what we see in these firsthand accounts.
There are multiple points of view in the book that try to represent the experience of the people who were there. Certainly the northern volunteers are the ones we've heard the most about over the intervening decades. But the local people, and there were at least 60 or 70,000 who risked their lives to participate, their voices have not come down the decades as clearly. Many had their homes firebombed or shot into simply for hosting white volunteers. When the officials were looking for the bodies of the three volunteers who were killed, they turned up other bodies as well, local black residents who had been active in the movement and whose disappearance had not been recorded. There are a large number of local heroes whose stories needed to be told, which was one reason we put the book together.
Did you also put it together because you were worried that these stories and the horror of what was going on has faded in our historical memory?
Well, it certainly has faded. And as I've gone around the state and the country talking to students, the young people are amazed that things could have been that bad.
In this country.
Yeah. A middle schooler in Kenosha told her teacher after looking at a Freedom Summer exhibit we created, she said, "I never knew my grandmother had to be that brave." And that was a high point of the project for me, because that's what we do in the history business, is we try to create those kinds of insights. But most Americans can't remember a world where everyone on TV was white, every official you interacted with was white, and all aspects of life were segregated. Freedom Summer, along with Selma, were the two catalysts that led to the overturn of segregation in America.
You've got these documents in your book. What are they? Where did they come from? What kind of written records did the participants leave?
The records came from a really creative and bold collecting effort that the Wisconsin Historical Society did just as the events were unfolding. Some of the volunteers came back to Madison to be UW graduate students, and they persuaded the director of the Historical Society that records at the grassroots level had to be collected. So he put them on the payroll and sent them back south, and they literally knocked on doors and went through segregated black neighborhoods in 66 and 67, asking people for their papers. Without that massive collecting evidence, they brought back tens of thousands of records. Without that collecting effort, we wouldn't know what happened on the ground in the civil rights movement in the South. We'd only have the central office files of the NAACP and institutional records like that.
That's amazing that there is that awareness that, hey, we're living history now. This is history being made, and we have to do something to preserve it.
The Historical Society has always thought of current events as just the froth on the wave of history. What was really important was that these young people were bold enough to risk their own lives to collect the records and make sure that the voices of marginalized and underrepresented activists survived.
That this is 3 or 4 years after the Freedom Summer itself. It was still a dangerous time and place to be.
People were still being killed. Yes.
You also, in the book, collect not just participants in the Freedom Summer, but opponents of Freedom Summer. I believe there are documents from the Ku Klux Klan in there, some governmental response. What kind of things did you feel were important to include?
Well, in creating any historical anthology of documents, you want to have as many points of view as possible. And so we did include the white supremacist point of view, both the Klan and more mainstream groups. White residents in the South took white supremacy and segregation for granted. It was normal. It's all they had ever known. It's what their ministers and their teachers taught them was proper. And that's an important point for people to grasp today, because we don't believe that today on such a large scale.
We've got these written records. This is a generation who some of them are no longer with us. They were killed then. They've passed on since. Is there an effort out there, do you know, is it important to collect oral histories from the people who are still around, still remember the terror of those days?
In fact, the Oral History Project started in the 1980s and 1990s. Many southern institutions by then were integrated, and they realized they had not collected evidence of this important turning point in their own history, and they went out and interviewed local people. The people, the students who went south and collected records for us brought some of the first portable tape recorders with them, and we have a few dozen interviews done in 65 and 66.
You mentioned sharing some of these stories with students in schools in the state. Kenosha, you mentioned, is this still an ongoing effort to pass on what you've collected here to today's students?
It is. We produced a teacher's guide for how to teach not just the history of Freedom Summer, but also Milwaukee's desegregation struggle in the years just afterwards, and distributed that to 1,000 social studies teachers around Wisconsin. That's still available if anybody wants, any teachers would like to contact me.
With very serious conversations, issues about race still going on in the United States, is the Wisconsin Historical Society collecting stories like this now, 2015?
Absolutely, absolutely. Race is one of the issues that will always be a big part of American history.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Michael Edmonds, Deputy Director of the Library Archives at the Wisconsin Historical Society. He's editor of the book Risking Everything, A Freedom Summer Reader. Prescription drug prices jumped into the news last week as doctors, patients, and others reacted angrily to a 5,000% price increase for medication. The drug Daraprim is not one of the better-known medications. It's used to treat a condition called toxoplasmosis. The company, Turing Pharmaceuticals, bought the rights to the drug and raised the price from $13.50 a pill to over $750 a pill. After a backlash, the company backed down, but not before the issue had drawn attention to other sudden large price increases at other companies and prompted some calls for reform. Democratic presidential candidates responded, saying some kind of fix was needed, and drug company shares went down. Two guests join us now for a look at prescription drugs, past and present. Joseph Gabriel is a visiting associate professor at the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy and author of the book Medical Monopoly, Intellectual Property Rights and the Origins of the Modern Pharmaceutical Industry. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Jeremy Green is an associate professor of medicine and the history of medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He's the author of the book Generic, The Unbranding of Modern Medicine. Jeremy, thanks for joining us again.
It's a pleasure to be here today, Rob. Thanks.
And Jeremy, I usually think of two categories of prescription drugs. The new patented brand name stuff could be really expensive. The generics, they're popular, a lot of producers, they're usually cheap. But the drug in this case and others are different. They have a relatively limited use. The people who need them seem to really need them. How common are these kind of medications?
Well, it's hard to give a precise number, but there are many classes of medicines in which old effective medicines, even medicines that are essential drugs by the classifications of the World Health Organization, have fallen into the hands of just a few, or even in the case of Daraprim and actually other drugs like albendazole for another Arab antiparasitic agent, where they're just produced by one company. And I think your question points at a real problem we have in the assumptions we make about how we balance innovation and access in pharmaceutical policy. We like to think that very new drugs that are innovative and are protected by a patent monopoly can be available at very high prices, that innovative companies can recoup the costs of development. And then once they go off patent, that all of these different generic companies swoop in and the invisible hand matches supply and demand and we have low prices. And for many drugs, it works that way, at least initially. But what we've come to learn, particularly in the last 10 years, is that for a large section of the pharmaceutical economy, generic competition either never happens or goes away, and we see these retro-monopolistic actions, which Martin Shkreli's actions at Turing Pharmaceuticals really brought to the forefront of the national attention this last week.
And Joe, let's go back in time a little. The system that Jeremy was referring to of intellectual property and patents, we take it for granted now. It wasn't always that way. In fact, you've written that the idea of patenting drugs and having monopolies on the rights was looked down on in the medical profession. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, sure. It wasn't just looked down on. It was considered patently. It was considered outright unethical. So in the decades before the Civil War, any kind of monopoly on a pharmaceutical was unethical, and it was attacked as a form of quackery. So if a drug company patented a drug, or they kept the ingredient secret, or they used some other kind of monopolistic practices, they were actually driven out of kind of respectable society. That began to change kind of towards the end of the 19th century, when there were new kind of scientific and technological developments. But the anti-monopoly perspective maintained as a very kind of central part of orthodox medical thought. And, you know, I should also say that there were a number of very intense efforts to try and prohibit patenting and other kinds of monopoly on drugs during the 19th century. The AMA, the American Medical Association, led the first effort to actually prohibit pharmaceutical patenting in 1847. Retail druggists made a similar effort towards the end of the century. And, you know, these efforts failed, but they do point to kind of this really deep public and scientific and professional concern about the role of monopoly in the marketplace.
Well, clearly a different vision ultimately won out. And Jeremy, the argument usually is, and you alluded to it already, that companies need to make profits. They need a monopoly to make the profit, at least for a while, to pay for a lot of research and development, a lot of which is fruitless, a lot of which doesn't ever produce a marketable product. Is there some argument to be made for that?
Well, I mean, I think the argument is made all the time, and we see the dollar value that is supposedly attached to any new drug that makes it through the FDA is consistently being inflated. I mean, a number of economists have called into question the means by which the industry comes up with this price tag of how much is spent for every new drug that is made available. But I guess the point I want to make, just to emphasize the importance of Joe's scholarship and then the point he was just making, is that we get locked in these really narrow debates about how can we deal with problems of drug prices because we need to incent development, and if we touch that, we're going to kill the goose that lays the golden eggs. And what I think historical scholarship can do to add to this debate is to show that there are many more options. And in fact, the whole system that we're debating was actually itself considered immoral and unacceptable to society not that long ago, historically speaking.
Talking to Dr. Jeremy Green and Joe Gabriel about prescription drugs, their prices, based on last week's flurry of news around a 5,000% price increase for a medication that's been around for a while, not a wide audience, essential for a lot of people. Joe, I want to pick up on that point Jeremy was just raising there, the history that led up to us thinking about prescription drugs and their pricing in this one particular way. So how did we go from that state where the medical community thought this is unethical to have monopolies on drugs to the current state of affairs where that is the state of affairs? That's how we do things.
Yeah, well, in the late 19th century, reformers were actually very concerned about the state of the drug market. So this was before there was a robust regulatory system in place. And, you know, a lot of the concern at that time was actually about drugs being too inexpensive, right? Because the idea was that as drug prices went down, the quality of products went down. And patents and trademarks, to a lesser extent, were actually seen by some reformers as a means of improving the quality of drugs in the marketplace, right? So you could take, if a very reputable firm took out a patent on a drug, it was, you know, reformers made the argument that that patent would allow the company to control the market and ensure high-quality products. So that was one of the ways kind of they justified the use of patents.
I want to talk about the role of doctors. Joe, you had been talking about doctors fighting the idea of intellectual property rights, monopolies on things. Well, now, in this Daraprim case that was in the news last week and others, it's doctors taking the lead in fighting these price increases and drawing attention to that. Have they always been as directly involved, Joe, in these issues, or is this something kind of new?
No, I think the medical community has always been one of the leading groups to oppose monopoly in the drug marketplace. Okay, you know, there's a sense in which monopoly, at least in the 19th century, was considered to impede science, right? If you monopolize information about a drug or the use of a drug, it interferes with the ability of other physicians to use that drug for the benefit of their patients, right? So monopoly was thought of as harming patients and harming the public good. You know, and so I think physicians have always had kind of an anti-monopolistic attitude towards the drug market. Personally, I think that, you know, physicians really need to kind of step up and take the lead on pushing an anti-monopolistic position in today's marketplace.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Sorry, just to amplify that point. I mean, I like Joe, I'm a historian. I'm also a practicing clinician, and I see patients in a community health center in East Baltimore. And many of the patients that I see really fall between the cracks in terms of the kinds of health plans that we have available. And every week, it seems, I learn of a new way in which a drug that I thought of as being so old that it must be broadly available for pennies a pill has been jacked up in price. So I want to amplify this because I think many of my colleagues in medicine make the assumption that old drugs, because they're old, are affordable. And one of the things that Shkreli has done this last week in this very publicized case of 5,000% price increase on an old drug invented in 1953 is to help to demonstrate that there is a role for advocacy, this kind of advocacy that clinicians should not assume that their patients can afford drugs just because they're old, that we need to continuously be listening to our patients and learning more about the things that we assume are affordable that in truth are not.
For doctors in other developed countries, can they make that assumption? Are things different enough there that this old but essential drug, they can prescribe it knowing that it isn't going to break the bank?
I mean, certainly in the case of Daraprim, this extraordinary price hike from $1,350 to $750 a pill is unique to the United States market. And, of course, in many sectors, really pretty much all sectors of the pharmaceutical marketplace, we pay the highest drug prices in the United States. Many advocates for the pharmaceutical industry say that it needs to be that way, that, in fact, the U.S. prices are propping up the entire system of innovation. But certainly a number of things take place to help markets be guaranteed in the U.S. where they would be fined more competitive if, for example, parallel importation of drugs in Canada or Europe were allowed for American consumers.
That's Dr. Jeremy Green, author of Generic, The Unbranding of Modern Medicine. Also with us is Joe Gabriel, author of Medical Monopoly, Intellectual Property Rights, and the Origins of the Modern Pharmaceutical Industry. We're looking at the story behind prescription drug prices after last week's news about a 5,000% increase in a medication got an outraged reaction, led to the company in question saying they were going to dial it back down. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a perspective as a patient or a provider or working in the pharmaceutical industry, love to hear what you think. And do you think something needs to change when it comes to the cost of prescriptions? Were you one of the people outraged by the news last week about this big jump in a drug price? Or do you think the cost of drugs is justified by the research and development that goes into them? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation with pharmacy professor Joe Gabriel at UW-Madison and Dr. Jeremy Green from Johns Hopkins. We're looking at the world of prescription medication and what it costs, past, present, maybe future. The issue hit the news last week after a small pharmaceutical company bought the rights to a prescription medication, increased its price by 5,000%. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 as a healthcare patient or provider. What do you think about drug prices? What confuses you about them? Do you think the system needs to change? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Go right to a caller. We've got Mary on the line in Boscobel. Mary, hi.
Hi. I just have a couple questions. One is, everywhere I looked, I've never found out how they're moving that price back down. Is it going to be down to $500 or down to $2 or what? And the other thing is, I'd like to know if these drug companies are receiving federal money in their research and development.
Mary, thanks for the call. Joe, you were shaking your head. I think we don't know what the price would go back down to that high.
I don't think he made it clear. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's a good chance that the company's just going to wait it out and reduce it by a very tiny amount, to be honest.
Jeremy, the role of government funding in R&D.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't know the specifics in the case of pyrimethidine, but certainly, that question really opens up a much broader thing in the case that, Turing Pharmaceuticals did absolutely nothing to develop pyrimethidine. So regardless of how much of that drug was developed privately versus publicly, absolutely 0% of its development came from investment from Turing Pharmaceuticals. Now, I'd like to add one other thing, which is no matter how much it goes down, let's say it went all the way back down to $13.50 a pill, one would ask, why is it even $13.50 a pill? And this is a drug that is old. It costs a tiny amount to make each pill. In other countries, it's available for much cheaper. Even before Turing acquired it, it was available already as a monopoly by another company that had already taken the price up to $13.50, which one could argue is already too high.
And Joe, the argument from Turing and again from other companies is these higher prices are buying the next generation of medications. Do you see it panning out that way?
Not really, to be honest. If we look over the course of the 20th century, the vast majority of scientific work that has gone into developing truly innovative new drugs has come out of the academy. It's come out of universities and the scientists who work at universities. Drug companies only invest maybe 15 to 18% of their budget back into the research and development process. They also have incredibly high profit margins. They have profit margins of about 20%. right? The oil industry, by comparison, only has a 10% profit margin. Okay, so these companies make a tremendous amount of money, and they're not putting back nearly as much into R&D as they, you know, as they kind of present themselves as doing. You know, a lot of their products are also not really that good. They're not necessarily innovations. They're just kind of marginal innovations on already existing products. So, you know, I personally don't really buy this whole kind of argument that they need to have these extreme prices in order to justify R&D expenses.
Mary, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Stuart with us in Chippewa Falls. Stuart, hi.
Hi. You just actually kind of touched on it, but I was just going to ask, if these drug prices are regulated and kept down, how are these pharmaceutical companies going to be able to continue research into developing new drugs? Because it does cost $1 billion for a new drug.
Jeremy, you want to jump in on that?
So I think it's an open question. So one could take a look at Turing Pharmaceuticals, for example, and say, well, they're charging $750 a pill, but they could, since they are the only company making the pill, just stop making the pill altogether if they decide it's unprofitable. So I think there is a real question here as to what happens when we entrust what is really an essential set of resources, part of what I would argue to be the basic infrastructure of modern biomedical practice, to a private industry and assume that the invisible hand is going to work to match supply and demand in a timely fashion for patients. And I think that the question as it was asked really applies to this concept of new drugs. What is so egregious about the Turing case is that it's an old drug, and these are these things that fall off of our sensibility, just as shortages in basic medical supplies because of oligopolistic and monopolistic tendencies have affected even the supply of something as simple as IV saline, salt water, which my clinic could not get for several weeks this last spring.
Joe, I know sometimes foundations hold patents. I mean, is there a nonprofit sector in the drug ownership and production world?
Not that I know of. I mean, not really, no.
Although I think that's a great question.
That's a great question.
One can imagine, why couldn't there be, especially for these older drugs like Daraprim?
Yeah, and the American Medical Association actually proposed doing that around 1914. They had a resolution on the floor of their organization that said that they would create a body that would hold patents for new drugs in the public interest. And that became the model for academic units to patent medicines kind of through the 20th century, right, the early 20th century. They would patent them, and then they would give licenses to drug companies, but the university would hold the patent in the public trust, right?
Talking to Joe Gabriel from UW-Madison's Pharmacy School, Dr. Jeremy Green from Johns Hopkins University, talking about prescription drugs and how prices are set. We'll go back to our callers now with Jeff in Appleton. Jeff, hi.
Hi. I've been a diabetic for 35 years, and I have to buy insulin to stay alive, basically. The problem with insurance with insulin and probably other drugs is that the only insulin I can purchase is labeled as a tier one drug. And when it's a tier one drug versus a two or a three, you have to pay almost the full amount of the insulin. There are no other choices. So in order to get the insulin I need to stay alive, I have to pay the full price because it's the only choice I have.
Jeff, thanks for that call. Jeremy, is this something you encounter with your patients in Baltimore?
Oh, certainly. And this is something I only became aware of in the past few years, that insulin is a drug that was invented in 1921, patented in 1923. I and pretty much all of my colleagues assumed that it was available generically at a very cheap price for people living with diabetes. And I learned, actually, that several of my patients were unable to afford their diabetes, partly because they didn't have insurance, or in the case of Jeff, that increasing exposure to patients of the true cost of medicines has made an essential medicine like insulin unreachable or potentially unreachable for patients who require it to survive. It's really an unthinkable situation, and yet it is happening for many, many people around the country today. One of the things that many people with diabetes have turned to as a result, because insulin is only, there is no generic insulin in the United States, it's only available in brand name form still in 2015 at very high prices, that Walmart paradoxically offers a $25 insulin. Now, it's a very basic form of insulin, and it's only through Walmart. It's because they have their market marketing muscle, or they can price it as a loss leader. But many people with diabetes have told me stories where they have, when they've moved, selectively sought out places with Walmarts so that they know they can live. And yet, this is a very thin protection. This is a private company doing this on its own with no fiduciary responsibility to people living with diabetes. They could terminate this program at any moment. So I think, Jeff, thank you for sharing your story. It's a tragic story, and it's one which I think needs much more attention.
Jeff, thanks for that call, and good luck to you. Ed is with us now in Lodi. Ed, hi.
Yes. I worked in the pharmaceutical industry for a number of years, and I just wanted to add a perspective on the cost and return of essentially introducing a new drug. When I was there, we had like a 1 in 7,000 success rate that a product we developed, or some new chemical that would be effective, would be successfully returned to the, you know, a successful return to the company. And the idea was that we did basic research, and we also worked with universities on the basic research, but then essentially if a drug looked promising, then we essentially had to go through process R&D that would basically say, well, how do you make this thing in volume in order to reach the numbers? And then at the same time, once you did all that, you had to go through the FDA approval process, the three stages, and then essentially then you had to look at the competitive marketing side.
Ed, thanks a lot for bringing that up. I want to bring our guests in on this. Given that finding a new drug can be a shot in the dark, Joe, how can we incentivize that kind of research and development being done?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, right? And especially, you know, I think for me at least, the real question is how can you incentivize research in a way that monopoly doesn't distort the market, right? Or monopoly doesn't lead to what are really unsustainable price barriers for people. You know, there's different models for how to do that. For example, the economist Joseph Stiglitz suggested offering very large prizes to companies who develop new products. There's other kinds of systems you could come up with that aren't reliant on kind of this cycle of patenting that leads to this kind of boom and bust system for companies.
And Jeremy, briefly as we wrap up, with this conversation that's been happening, that flared up last week over drug price increases, do you think there's a realistic possibility that some kind of change, maybe for the better, could happen in the next 5-10 years?
Oh, I think there is, and I think there really needs to be some form of change. I think one thing to focus on, you know, if you look at the case of Martin Shkreli, you know, he went out before the cameras and has become, in some ways, like the most hated person in America this week. Who knows who the most hated person will be next week? But, you know, the social media is full of accounts calling him a jerk, referring to him as Pharma Bro. That's become the preferred name for referring to him. And I think the problem here is that this attack can so quickly get limited to just an ad hominem. And really what Shkreli is doing is almost serving as an illustration of the power of monopoly in the American pharmaceutical sector for old drugs as well as for new drugs. So in many ways, Shkreli's done a tremendous service to those who want to see essential medicines available for afforded prices for Americans by showing how egregiously important this subject is. And I think there is a lot of potential for change.
Jeremy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
And Joe, thanks to you as well.
Yeah, thank you very much.
We've been talking to Dr. Jeremy Green from Johns Hopkins University, author of Generic, The Unbranding of Modern Medicine, and Joseph Gabriel, visiting associate professor at the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy. His book is Medical Monopoly, Intellectual Property Rights, and the Origins of the Modern Pharmaceutical Industry.